And welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine here on AM 580 WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Celeste Quinn. Our guest this hour is Anita Pratap, a journalist who is the author of Island of Blood, Frontline Reports from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and Other South Asian Flashpoints. Anita Pratap filed those reports for several Indian publications, such as India Today and the Indian Express, as well as Time Magazine and CNN. And I must admit, as I read this book, I was trying to think, have I ever reported on anything dangerous ever at all? And I don't think I have, Anita, but welcome to the show. You have certainly been in a lot of dangerous places.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be on your show.
You have, you're now, I believe, if I looked at your bookstore schedule, you're now out on the West Coast?
That's right.
And so you've been traveling around the U.S. for a little while now.
Yeah, that's right. It's literally 10 cities in 10 days.
Okay, I believe, are you in San Francisco right now?
That's right, yes. I got in day before, and I will be here for another day.
In Island of Blood, you contrast a lot of these dangerous assignments you've gone out on with life with your family, which is, of course is very peaceful and warm and friendly. I felt that I knew as much about them by the end of the book as I knew about all you had told us about the Sri Lankan ethnic conflicts and the Taliban, etc. Is your family coming along with you on this trip?
No, they wanted to, but then, you know, work, as my son is a lawyer now and he was starting work, and my husband had to go off on assignments, so neither of them could be here. You know, the reason why I did this, Jim, was because I was going into areas that are so alien to most people, to most journalists even. And so to create a sense of identity, I am normal like everybody else, and we all are the same. Deep down inside, we are the same. We are so happy. We celebrate when a child is born. We love it when we are on a fun holiday. So I take my readers on this, you know, same journey that they can identify, you know, with completely. And then suddenly, you know, I transport them to another world, a horrible experience that I have, you know, gone through in my professional life. But by this time, they are with me, and they're seeing it through my eyes. And I think with that, I'm hoping that they would experience the same kind of horror that I have experienced in my professional life.
It is dramatic. In chapter one, you start with your son, Zubin. And as a matter of fact, you write about the birth of your son, Zubin, in chapter one. And then you're with him a few years later, very friendly banter, actually. And then a few pages later, you're out in the jungle. You're risking getting fired upon by Indian troops, all to get an interview with the Tamil rebel leader. And please help me with the pronunciation here.
Prabhakaran
of the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE,
yes.
Which happened a few years, which happened in 1987. I have to confess, I was thinking about this as I was reading this. Where was Zubin? Where was your son?
Well, he was a small boy. He was just 6 years old. He was at home having no idea what his mother was up to. In fact, it's only when this book came out in India about 2 years ago that my parents and my son read it for the first time and had an idea of what I was really up to the last 20 years. And they were so scared. My mother was trembling. She couldn't read beyond the first chapter.
You didn't tell them all that you were doing during those trips?
No, Jim, I just couldn't. I mean, they're normal parents. My son is normal. He's a six-year-old child. How can you tell them exactly the dangers that you are facing? Because that would terrify them even more. So very often, I would even tell them, you know, I'm going to Colombo. I'm not going up to Jaffna. Or if I was going to Afghanistan, I would say, I'm just going to northern India. You know, not be very specific about where I was going. But then, you know, come back and tell them. But never give them a real clue about what was going on, because there's very little that they could do. But, you know, during my absence, they would just be so terrified and worried. And as it is, my mother would, whenever I went on assignment, she would light her candle and pray and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, they are normal parents. And it's just that I, of course, never ever thought that I was on a suicide mission. I was absolutely confident of myself. I was going into areas that I was reasonably familiar with. And, you know, you have the sense of, I guess it's foolhardy, but you feel that, you know, bad things things happen to other people. And, of course, that's not true. So many journalists have died in conflict situations. But I felt it's not going to happen to me because I'm part and parcel of this culture and I know this, you know, terrain so well.
I want to get our phone numbers out for those listeners who would like to call in with their questions for Anita Pratap. It's 333-9455, 333-9455. Or if you're calling from out of town, call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. How did you, or was it something that you you definitely decided to do, that you were going to cover... you were going to go where the action was as far as some of the major South Asian conflicts of the last few years?
I think it's a matter of destiny. I just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And I kind of strayed into journalism, but having got into journalism, I loved reporting because it meant meeting, you know, different people, going to new situations. And so it was perfectly suited to my temperament. And, you know, I had done a lot of research on the Sri Lankan situation. And so when the riots broke out in 1983, I was, you know, perfectly positioned to cover the story, except my editor didn't think it was appropriate to send me. I was only 24 years old. I was a young woman. And, you know, to send into this dangerous area where even Indians were being attacked was just completely not all right as far as he was concerned. But then I was, you know, determined. I felt I had earned the story and I had to do this story because I understood, you know, the dynamics of the problems that finally led to this kind of, you know, terrible rioting.
And that's part of the question I'd like to ask you. It's hard to sum these things up, but the Sri Lankan conflict is something which I don't think is so much on the American public's radars, but it's been a bitter conflict for like some 20 years. What is at the heart of it?
Well, it is the minority Tamils who feel discriminated by the majority Sinhalese. There were certain discriminatory laws whereby the Tamils had to get higher grades to get into higher education, were not able to get jobs, and so they started protesting. Initially, of course, there were some democratic ways of trying to redress the problem, but that didn't work, and so finally there was an armed struggle, and that just, you know, blew completely out, and there were the Sinhalese, you know, sections of society that wanted to punish the Tamils, and it just went out of control. Yes, it's true that the world does not know about, you know, Sri Lankan terrorism and the problem, the ethnic struggle. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that in India and in Sri Lanka, we've been coping with terrorism for more than 20 years. And there are certain lessons that can be learned from our experience.
And as I noted, I was looking at some of your columns in Outlook India that you're writing now, and you wrote last month with about the conflict in Sri Lanka with an optimism that I really couldn't quite see in the book written 2 years ago.
Well, you know, the only difference is that there is a peace process going on. The only difference is that earlier when peace processes broke, there was an automatic resumption of violence. This time the peace talks are faltering, but as yet there is no resumption, you know, of violence. And I think we have to take hope from that. You know, the trouble is it's so hard. There's years and years of mistrust and hostility, and it's so hard for the two groups now to come and, you know, negotiate with a certain degree of trust. And that's it's just a difficult situation. And this is what, you know, leaders and communities don't realize. It is so easy to go to war, but it is so hard to make peace.
You seem to have developed some sort of bond with the leader of the Tamil Tigers. I mean, a professional bond of reporter to interviewee. And he seems to have been seems to be a truly remarkable man, and the Tamil Tigers, a remarkable group at the same time possessing some monstrous qualities.
Yes, I mean, we were talking about this issue about, you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. I mean, we were talking about this in the 80s because the Tamils did see Prabhakaran as their national hero, whereas the Sinhalese saw him as a monster. And this is why it is so hard to kind of, you know, reduce people in black and white terms. There are good points and there are bad points. There are good points in this man. He's a man with tremendous foresight. He has, you know, redeemed, you know, Tamil national honor. But on the other hand, he is the one who sanctions suicide bombings. There's a large number of people who have been killed, innocent people who have been killed in this struggle. And so there is the other aspect. He has, you know, ruthlessly wiped out dissent and other rivals. So there is the good and the bad, and that is what it is in most of us. Not to that degree, agreed, but then it is, I think, quite dangerous to, you know, lionize or demonize people in conflict situations, which is invariably what happens.
When I look at your description of what seems to be an amazing discipline among the Tamil Tigers. And I was starting to think about what is it that makes this group attractive, attractive to the Tamils or people among people among that ethnic group in Sri Lanka. It also started me thinking of what makes it attractive among some people in the Middle East and the Muslim world to follow someone like Osama bin Laden and a group like Al Qaeda. Are there any similarities as far as the way that mindsets developed along those paths?
Oh yes, there are definite similarities. You know, there is a sense of pride being wounded among a community, and I think that's what's happened in the case of the Muslims and in the case of the Tamils. They felt that their national honor had been trampled upon, their community honor had been trampled upon, and then comes a man who redeems that honor, who puts up a stiff fight, who seems to have no personal stake. He's not the kind of person who is going in Cadillacs or whatever. I mean, Osama bin Laden had a background, but you know, later you see him going around in his, you know, he's walking around or, you know, living in tents and so on and so forth. So the community feels that this is a man who is truly committed to redeeming or fighting a cause, and you know, love or revere or admire him for these reasons. But for that very same reasons, you have the other side that would demonize, and quite rightly so in some cases. But I am very wary of a situation where especially the media tends to do this, you know, lionizing or demonizing, and therefore you blur the lines. There are good points and there are bad points. But the point is that terrorists are like fish. I mean, they can survive only if there is civilian support, just as fish cannot survive if there is no water. So also terrorists cannot survive if there is no civilian support. And unfortunately, when governments try to tackle terrorism, when they go along a military path to solving the problem, invariably they exacerbate the situation, driving more civilians into the arms of the terrorists, so to speak. So one has to be very careful. There has to be a holistic way of trying to deal with terrorism. There has to be a military component because there are bigoted groups that you cannot talk to. But at the same time, they have to be neutralized militarily. But there are other aspects which require a political approach, which require an economic approach, and a tendency to redress the grievance. Because underlying this conflicts are a sense of grievance experienced by the whole community, which the terrorists kind of, you know, bring to the fore. So that grievance has to be addressed. Now, the grievance can be real, it can be perceived. Even if it is only a perception, the fact is that it has to be addressed.
In the case of in the case of this conflict in Sri Lanka, do you think that that the government has begun to do that?
Oh, yes, the government, there has been a realization. And this is the unfortunate thing. One conflict begins. It takes about 10 to 20 years before people realize that this is an unwinnable war, before they come to a realization, yes, certain mistakes have been made and we have to address those mistakes. And the Sri Lankan government is fully aware of the fact that the Tamils do have a genuine grievance and that has to be addressed. So it is the, you know, government, the Prime Minister, who is going all out to now try and, you know, get the Tigers over, get them into the mainstream, get them into the, you know, democratic mainstream. Of course, this is very difficult because there are any number of groups that are, you know, that have, as we call, a vested interest in perpetuating the conflict. They are a small group, but they can hold the, you know, process to hostage. And the, you know, the fact is that ordinary people, wherever they are, whether it's Kabul, whether it's Jaffna, whether it is here in San Francisco, ordinary people just want normalcy. They want stability and peace so that they can attend to their economic progress. And that is exactly what the people in the Tamil areas of Sri Lanka, they crave for this. But there are groups that just want this, to perpetuate the conflict. And the point is we have to try and neutralize these small groups. They are small, but they are powerful. They are entrenched. And we just have to build people-to-people contact so that, you know, peace has a way of striking deep roots. Once peace, you know, strikes deep roots and people get addicted to peace, they realize that they can build their lives now, it becomes that much more difficult to disrupt a peace process.
We're talking with Anita Pratap, a journalist from South Asia, who has reported extensively on such places as Sri Lanka and the ethnic conflict there, the Taliban in Afghanistan, and Hindu-Muslim conflicts in India as well. Her book is Island of Blood, Frontline Reports from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and Other South Asian Flashpoints, now out in a trade paperback edition from Penguin Books. And we welcome your calls at 333-9455. The toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. You have been to Afghanistan and reported on the Taliban there. I take it just as they were taking hold in that country?
That's right. That was in 1996.
So almost 10 years ago. How much of a shock was it to the region at the time for the Taliban to be taking power like that?
I mean, it was being expected because they had control over, you know, Kandahar and those areas, and they were rapidly, you know, capturing territories all across Afghanistan. But, of course, the one who captures Kabul is the one who rules Afghanistan. And so it was expected, but, you know, finally when they did arrive on the scene, initially people were happy. The people of Afghanistan were happy because the Mujahideen who were ruling before had turned on each other, and there was so much violence and extortion and complete lawlessness. Whereas when the Taliban came, they came in with a certain degree of discipline, and there was a certain degree of peace and security. But very quickly, people realized that it came at the price of freedom, because they imposed a very fundamentalist regime, and which was very restrictive, both as far as men and women were concerned, but extremely cruel, I would say, when it came to women.
And were people not expecting that? Or I mean, it's not like the Taliban,
you know, the
had made a secret.
The people of Kabul were totally different. I mean, even under the Soviet rule, they had a certain degree of freedom. I mean, women were working, and they were working, you know, side by side with men. So they were used to a degree of freedom and education. And then suddenly comes the Taliban that banned women from education. They banned women from working. And suddenly everyone's life just went for a six, and it became so dangerous for women to work. I mean, there was a situation in Kabul where there were 50,000 widows. Widows who were the sole breadwinners in their family. Each of these widows had about 4 to 6 children. Who was going to feed them? The woman had to work. There are no, you know, soup kitchens or any security network that, you know, they could draw upon. They were left to fend for themselves, and then suddenly comes a regime which says that, no, you're not allowed to work. Then provide some food for the children. No, but that's not available. Then what are these women to do? So just to go out and work was asking for a kind of lethal punishment, and yet they had to do, because how else to feed the children? There were women who were so poor, not only did they have to work, poor and destitute, so they had to work to, you know, eat. And yet they were so poor, they did not even own a burqa, the, you know, chador that they had to wear. So they were flouting the Taliban on two counts. First, they were working because they had to, you know, earn money to eat. And secondly, when they went back home, they didn't have a chador to cover themselves in. And that was, again, you know, asking for extreme punishments from the Taliban. So it was a really, you know, heartbreaking situation to watch the plight of women under the Taliban regime.
It was very interesting to me to read about that in your book, and thinking of thinking of in Islamic teachings and in the Quran, the specific instructions to help the poor and destitute, widows specifically, and the Taliban had made no allowances for that?
Yeah, you know, the Taliban, I don't think they were following Islam. They had perverted and misused religion, and in the process brought a lot of dishonor to Islam. This was actually what the Taliban and a lot of other people do is, you know, it is tribalism what they are practicing, and they have co-opted Islam to get a certain religious or moral sanction. But none of this is said in Islam. So it is tribalism which is being flaunted by them, which is being perpetuated by them. And tribalism is a very feudal patriarchal system where, you know, women have a very low status, and but they have misused religion. And in this process, I think, unfortunately, across the world, there is a misunderstanding of Islam and what it actually stands for. And one of the things I really hope is that Islamic scholars, moderates, would come up front and expose the lies that these people are perpetuating in the name of Islam.
Well, of course, there's been a lot of changes in Afghanistan with the American invasion following the September 11th attacks and the change of governments there, and apparently the rout of the Taliban. Have you kept in touch with things in Afghanistan?
Yes, to a degree, yes.
What do you think is really happening out there for everyday people? And is there a difference between the city and the countryside?
Oh, yes. There is a big difference between what is in Kabul and in the countryside. You know, very little changes in the countryside, whatever happens. It is the old way of life. I mean, this is the kind of country where, you know, vendetta carries on for 500 years. It's, you know, revenge is, you know, something that they say revenge is a dish that tastes best when cold. So it doesn't matter, you know, if you kill somebody else's son, it is that person's, you know, great-great-grandchild who's going to take revenge on your family, and the feuds go on for 500 years, and that's the way the tribal, the countryside, you know, still functions. They go across, they, you know, follow certain principles. But the fact is that the towns are different, and unfortunately what has happened in Afghanistan is that it has degenerated back into warlordism, and it is, you know, each area is carved into little fiefdoms, and the local warlord rules. And it depends on the warlord how, you know, bad or evil or wicked he is. The fact is that there is no one Afghanistan. That is just a, you know, concept in our heads. The fact is that Afghanistan is divided into various regions. And the tragedy is that the media has, you know, forgotten Afghanistan again. I mean, this is Afghanistan's fate always. For a while, everybody dissents on it, and there is a great deal of news, and then everybody chooses to forget it and go on. Now everybody is focused on Iraq, but, you know, people are unmindful about what is going on. And it is a pity, because there are lessons to be learned from the Afghanistan experience. And if the media stayed focus, they would force the administrations to be, you know, governments to, you know, stay focused, and that would help in their ability to deal properly in Iraq.
Afghanistan now, when you see the news coverage, the Western news coverage coming out of it, when they do look at Afghanistan, are they getting it right?
Well, I think there have been a few reports that I have read, for instance, in the New York Times, which is excellent, which mentioned, you know, this relapse into warlordism. But there isn't that degree of attention from either television or, you know, in the worldwide media about what is really going on over there, and how things have just slid back to lawlessness, extortion and violence. And, you know, the people are suffering as they were in the past. I mean, there has been no improvement.
While all these various problems are happening in South Asia, of course, in the last year, the U.S. went into Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein's government there. Can you talk at all about the range of opinion you've seen from your region in the world about that?
You know, what is most worrisome for America is this anti-Americanism that, you know, today is such a big factor in American consciousness. But what is truly worrisome about this is that it is not confined to just the Islamic world. Then we can rationalize and, you know, we can talk about it. But I think there is a need for greater scrutiny, simply because this is a worldwide phenomenon. And there is this anti-Americanism that you see in countries like India or Sri Lanka, or even in Europe, you know, Germany or France, or, you know, Austria, Norway, countries that are, you know, first world and have, you know, had an equation with America, which has, you know, been long-standing and traditional. But there is this perception that, you know, America doesn't practice what it preaches, and this double standards, or this, you know, quality of arrogance, which most people perceive. Now, it doesn't matter whether it's real or whether it's a perception. If it is a worldwide perception, there is a problem that needs to be addressed.
I want to get back to the topic in just a moment. We have a call, and I want to go ahead and take our first caller from calling by cell phone from Iroquois County on line one. Good afternoon. You're on the Afternoon Magazine.
Good afternoon. Fascinating discussion. I had a question that perhaps you can tie it into what you were just talking about, because I find that very interesting. But earlier when you were discussing the Taliban, you had said that basically whoever captures or rules Kabul can rule Afghanistan, but in what I've been reading, it seems that that's kind of the approach that the American military has taken, capturing Kabul and leaving the rest of the country open, and it doesn't really seem to be working. I wonder if you could perhaps discuss that a little bit and perhaps tie that into the anti-Americanism, which I'm sure that feeds greatly.
You know, this is how Afghanistan has always been. There's somebody who rules Kabul, but that somebody does not rule the rest of the nation. That is traditionally how it has always been. And usually the ruler in Kabul is quite happy to leave those other, you know, far-flung regions to themselves because it is impossible to rule the whole country. In fact, when I visited in 1996, I was just shocked to go to another province and discover that it was a completely country within a country which had its own visas and it had its own airline and it had its own military troops and currency, which, of course, we had no clue. But that's the way it has traditionally been, and I don't think there was a perception or an understanding of this anywhere in the world. As far as anti-Americanism is concerned, of course, Afghanistan and, you know, in the entire Muslim world you find it, and in Afghanistan you find it even more because, you know, it's one thing that they don't like the Taliban. That's, you know, perfectly understandable, and a lot of them were so happy to see them go. But then when you have another force coming in and it turns out to be an occupying force, or a force that is, you know, and now, for instance, in Kabul, you have a government which is just confined to Kabul alone. Nowhere else does this government's writ run. Then there is a sense of, you know, a sense of grievance. And again, unfortunately, the way the media covered this conflict was not very good for America, because there were instances when the people died, ordinary people died, and when that is dismissed as collateral damage, people get upset. It just gets, you know, the media's coverage aggravates this anti-Americanism.
Well, I was wondering about that. Are there parts of Afghanistan, of certainly the Taliban have not entirely gone away? I think they're still out there. And do they find some favor or less disfavor in some parts of Afghanistan?
You know, if you go into the absolutely rural and backward areas, there is a certain degree of support for the Taliban. Again, because it is tribalism, wherever their tribals there are concentrated, the Pashtuns, again, you find a certain degree of support. So these are, you know, pockets, and they will continue to be there. And this is the area which is bordering Pakistan, and this is what we call the Pashtun belt. I mean, the Pashtuns on both sides, Afghans as well as Pakistan. And this is going to be a crucial area. I mean, a lot of attention has to be focused in this area because, you know, even the Pakistan's government's writ does not fully run in these border areas. It is the tribal leaders who have complete control. They have their own militias, and they have even their court systems. And this is a, you know, safe haven for the Taliban to regroup, and I think this is going to be one of the crucial trouble spots in the world in the coming years.
And I didn't know if our caller from Iroquois County is still on the line. If you had, okay. Well, thank you very much for calling in. We're at about the halfway point here on the Afternoon Magazine with our interview with Anita Pratap, journalist based in South Asia and author of Island of Blood, Frontline Reports from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and other South Asian flashpoints. Her website, by the way, is anitapratap.com. That's A-N-I-T-A-P-R-A-T-A-P, where you can find out more about her and read some of her work as well. You've been filing reports from for Outlook India as you travel in the U.S., I take it.
Yes, that's right.
From looking at your latest column for the magazine, you're writing about the American opinion on the war in Iraq. And the point that struck me is that you write about what you call a growing groundswell of public opinion against President George Bush.
And the funny thing is that, you know, I had written this column, you know, before the latest public opinion polls came out, you know, and I think there you see a certain reduction in Bush's popularity. But it just seemed to me when I was traveling around, like I said, you know, 10 cities in 10 days, of course now it's 15 days. And it just, whoever I was meeting, and of course, it is true that, you know, people who come for book readings represent the liberal intellectual, you know, sections, and that's, you know, just one, you know, segment of American population. But I'm also taking a lot of car rides, I'm taking a lot of planes every day, I'm, you know, dealing with baggage handlers and, you know, security people, and it just is so amazing to see the kind of, you know, concern and irritation at a, you know, it's a murmur level, you know, as we call it. It's not the screaming level. So I guess that's why the media is not picking it up.
It's that it's not something that shows up when people, when opinion polls call up people?
Is it I don't know why it is not showing up. I mean, you know, the fact is just yesterday I saw a poll where it said that people were asked, you know, when do you want the troops to return from Iraq? And 52% said they wanted the troops back now. That's more than half the people who are polled. So, you know, I mean, I wrote this column, you know, about 10 days ago. I mean, about a week ago at least. And, you know, it is showing up in polls. But what I'm saying is that, you know, I mean, this has begun already. And the media will pick it up along the way. I'm sure of that. But right now, it doesn't seem to be as strong. To me, it seems because, you know, I'm an outsider. I'm watching everything, you know, with my eyes are, you know, popping, you know, wide open. My ears are wide open. I guess, you know, I pick up more things simply because everything is so new to me. And whereas there is so much of the buzz that, you know, a person who's been living here may perhaps fail to, you know, notice the, you know, shift when it's happening.
And have you come across any people who do support the effort and think that it's necessary and it's something that that we have to stay the course with?
You know, I think there is a sense of patriotism, or some people feel badly about, you know, saying something negative about their president and their system. Though by and large, I'm quite amazed at how forthcoming Americans are and how open they are in discussing, much more than I think we Indians are. I think we Indians have this tendency that we can criticize our government, but we don't want outsiders to do that. And, you know, so I am a little embarrassed about, you know, saying, unless I'm asked for, I don't want to, you know, come up front and, you know, say something, because I feel, you know, Americans might not take kindly to who is this foreigner to come and, you know, talk about our, you know, politics. But so often I'm been asked about what is going on. And then when I turn around and ask them, I'm just amazed at, you know, their reaction. There is a degree of anger about what people say, that, you know, President Bush and this administration lied to us about this war. I mean, that's what I've picked up. You know, the single biggest point that I picked up in this last, you know, fortnight was people's sense of, you know, they're not used to, you know, being lied to. And now there is this perception that, you know, they were lied to about this war. And I think that is what is causing a lot of concern.
You know, at the same time, do people ever talk about it to you in the context of a war on terrorism, and that something still needs to be done about the forces that engineered the September 11th
attacks? Oh, yes, absolutely. Everybody agrees that, you know, you cannot talk to terrorists. I mean, you have to neutralize them. You have to militarily deal with them. But whether Iraq, going into Iraq, was the right step, nobody is very sure, because earlier it wasn't the hub of terrorism. But today President Bush himself says that this is, you know, the center of terrorism. It has happened precisely because of the, you know, the war and the consequences. Today you have not only the local resistance fighters, but it has become a haven for all the, you know, Islamic jihadists around the world to congregate at this spot. And, you know, Iraq seems to have become one of the big hubs of terrorism. And that is a cause for concern. And I think that is what is concerning Americans. And in fact, there was another thing that I, you know, encountered, and that was Americans seem to feel that enough is not being done as far as their homeland security is concerned. Everywhere, whenever I said that, oh, security is so tough on airports, and people felt, oh, but, you know, we've been having these, you know, reports, and people have managed to sneak in without with all kinds of things, you know, box cutters. And they, so Americans feel that there still could be a great deal of improvement in the defensive aspect of, you know, coping with terrorism, which is, you know, being more vigilant and not allowing things to come through, whether it's through containers or through people. So that's, you know, so Americans, you know, recognize the need for that. And even if it, you know, aggravates their, you know, the comfort level when it comes to travel, I think they're prepared for it. And they clearly seem to feel that more should be done to make security, you know, more foolproof than it is.
We have about 12 minutes left in our interview with Anita Pratap, journalist from South Asia and the author of Island of Blood, Frontline Reports from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and Other South Asian Flashpoints. You can talk to her by calling us up at 333-9455 or call toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. This book was first published in India a couple of years ago. And can you tell me anything about the response you got from readers there?
And the book was actually hit the stands a few days before 9/11. the book was sold out in 6 days, which is, you know, an unprecedented publishing record. And then, of course, it went into, you know, reprints, you know, 3 months, three reprints, and it's really been what Penguin, you know, calls an instant bestseller. See, the book is not a scholarly work. It's not an academic presentation of conflict, because I would lose my readers. Having been a journalist, I know that if you get too much into the history, you lose your readers. This book is written from my heart for lay readers. And it's really, you know, it takes you on a journey into the heart of terrorism. You come face to face with suicide bombers, kind of situations that are quite unbelievable. But it is written almost as if it's fiction. It's a very easy read. And I think this book would prove my favorite point, which I've come to, you know, I've come to that conclusion only after being in journalism for 25 years and been to all these places. I do believe that reality is much more dramatic, much more terrifying, much more comic than real life, than fiction. And I think this book would, you know, prove that that reality can be so powerful.
One of the one of the chapters which caught my attention was you're writing about a mosque in, is it Ayodhya? I'm really going to try hard.
Yes, Ayodhya. That's right. Yes.
Ayodhya.
Yes.
The Babri Masjid in,
yes,
Ayodhya, which was torn down 11 years ago by radical Hindus for essentially for grievances, which I guess go back centuries.
Exactly. Goes back to 500 years. And, you know, if we start settling scores now for so-called historical wrongs, then we are not going to have a future. We are sacrificing our present and we are going to, you know, betray our future. We are not going to have a future. So, I mean, these are problems which should be left behind. And let's focus on the real issues, which is providing drinking water and education. You know, there are 300 million Indians who do not have access to basic toilet facilities, who are not educated, who go to bed hungry every night. What are we talking about an ancient mosque that nobody cares? That was, you know, it was not even a mosque that was being used.
It was not an operating mosque in
1992? It was not an operating
mosque. What was happening to the building?
You know, the point is that there are Hindus who believe that this is where Lord Ram, you know, one of the most important deities in the Hindu pantheon, was, this is his birthplace, and there a temple existed over there. And, you know, when the Muslim conquerors came, they broke down that temple and built a mosque over here. I mean, there are archaeological surveys that are conducted, and it depends on who you talk to. Nothing is so clear or defined. I mean, we had a recent survey which said, yes, maybe there was a church, there was a temple, but you have historians say, you know, that evidence is very, very shaky. Who knows? I mean, we don't know for sure what exactly existed. But in any case, this is a mosque which is not even being in, you know, was not even in use. So let's get on with our future. Why? But the whole country came to a standstill. It was the, you know, big campaign, and it resulted in so much of Hindu-Muslim rioting and bloodshed, and economically we suffered. I mean, why go through all this? I mean, even today, this is a festering problem in India. And what amazes me is, I mean, does India lack any major problems for us to be sitting and, you know, focusing on, you know, something which is 500 years old and which doesn't really matter? I mean, there are enough mosques and temples in India for, you know, people to go and pray in. So why get focused on this? This is just a cynical, diabolical attempt to get votes. You get the majority Hindu vote, so then you come to power. This is, again, a misuse of religion. And unfortunate thing is that it is happening to all the major religions in the world. A small group is misusing religion for a very diabolical purpose of coming to power.
Is it just a matter of, I mean, you describe it as almost being a matter of rabble-rousers, but it sounds like there must be issues and conflicts that go, well, at least back to partition for India and for the Muslims that remain in India.
Yes, I mean, the animosity between the Hindus and Muslims go back to that time, and that is why we have this problem between India and Pakistan, which is a lingering problem even today. I mean, right now, there is a degree of peace, but just last year, we were almost at war, and it is an area of concern because this is a Hindu-Muslim issue. It is the partition of India, and there are enough people to exploit this for the sake of, you know, perpetuating themselves in power, whereas ordinary people, both in India and Pakistan, want to put their history behind and focus on their future, which is only through economic development.
What has happened to that site, the site where the mosque was?
Well, it is under government control, and there is a makeshift temple where there is a little idol of Lord Ram, but the mosque doesn't exist. In any case, the Muslims were not praying at this mosque, so
Are the Hindus using the temple there?
No, right now there is under government control, and they were having excavations because part of this, the whole thing is under litigation right now.
Mm-hmm.
So it is before the courts, and so they were having these excavations to find out whether temple existed in the past.
And of course, that may not be an answerable question.
Yeah, I mean, finally, at the end of the day, they say this is a matter of faith. And millions of Hindus believe that this is the place where Lord Ram was born. And so you have to, faith is beyond scientific scrutiny. Then why did we go through all this, the courts and everything, if that was the case? And then again, this is the way that, the issue will be kept alive till the next elections. And, when that happens, this will be blown up again. And this is the tragedy, is that it is so easy to sway human emotions, especially when it has a religious connotation, because, Indians are God-fearing people. Hindus are God-fearing people, exactly as Muslims are. And so it is easy to whip up, the rabble-rousers can whip up public fervor on this issue.
The United States is a nation which still, despite some of the terrible things that have happened here, not just September 11th, but other things, is, I guess, a nation relatively free of terrorist attacks. South Asia sounds like a place where many more things have happened, and I'm wondering, how does that affect not strictly the regions where these the cities where these things happen, but the region as a whole? How does that affect how society works?
You come to terms with this. Very quickly, you realize that you have to be up and running. You can't be afraid. You can't mourn. You have to move on. Life moves on. And that is, again, an underlying message in my book that, we have to celebrate the ordinary. We have to appreciate normalcy when we have, because instead of, whining and complaining and getting frustrated by the very normalcy that we have, people in Jaffna or Kabul, all that they crave for is the very normalcy that we take for granted. So the underlying message in my book is precisely this, appreciate what you have, because all it takes is a second for life to change. And bomb explosions prove that. 9/11 proves that. So people in India have come to terms with that, I think, as much as New Yorkers have to a great extent. This year, I think 9/11 wasn't commemorated with that level of, anguish or whatever. People want to move on. They get tired of, staying focused on their grief, because that's what life is all about. That's what survival is about. That's what human spirit is about. We have to look forward to the future, and people tend to move on. And, you get very used to a degree. I mean, how do people in, Israel, and how do they function? How do people in Palestine function? They lead normal lives to the extent, that they can. So I think we who have a degree of normalcy should just be so glad and, make the most of it while we have it.
And at the same time, does change happen, the change that can make normalcy genuine in an area which has been ravaged by these sort of conflicts?
I think time has come for us to be a little more active in fighting for peace. I think people like us have been blasé about this, and we have taken our normalcy and our freedom for granted, and there are many people out there who want to wreck it. And I think time has come for us to be, the civil society, to be more aggressive, more assertive in protecting these freedoms, because life without freedom and democracy is such a nightmare. And I think we have to do much more in terms of protecting and safeguarding our freedoms.
You're a freelance reporter now. A lot of the stuff that you did for Island of Blood was for news outlets like CNN and Time magazine. Are you covering the same sort of things? Are you going to the same sort of flashpoints that you were as a reporter on assignment?
No, I'm not. I'm taking a break from breaking news, because it was like more than 20 years of doing the same thing, and I started fatiguing. I started tiring. And I realized that I was, staying on for too long, when I realized on a Sunday afternoon when a bomb exploded, and my first reaction was, oh my God, not another bomb explosion. I think it's terrible when journalists become cynical or tired. I think this is the death of a good journalist. And so I decided to take, stand back a little bit. And, one of the despairing things is that history does repeat itself. And having been 20 years in this profession, just being there, in the front lines all the time, I think was, was tiring me out. And I also believe that it's so important to reinvent myself, and because only then you can, you know, be creative and be excited and energetic about what you're doing. And right now I'm going through another one of my avatars, as we call it, you know, reincarnating myself from a breaking news journalist into a commentary and, you know, analytical, you know, writer, as well as, you know, trying to evolve into an author. So I'm working on my second book now.
What is your second book going to be about?
My second book is also, it's a murder. It's something that really happened. It's also for Penguin. And I kind of revisit this crime. It is not an ordinary crime. There are, you know, layers and within layers. There are wheels within wheels. And it's, you know, it's recreating the whole thing and how, you know, people just have no idea. There are these warning signals, but, you know, people just don't pick it up and then pay the ultimate price, which is, you know, this particular man, a very good man, was, you know, murdered in the most horrific manner.
Well, Anita Pratap, I want to thank you very much for being with me today on The Afternoon Magazine. Anita Pratap is the author of Island of Blood, Frontline Reports from Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, and Other South Asian Flashpoints, now available from Penguin Books. And you can also read more of her work at anitapratap.com. And Anita, thank you very much for speaking with us today on The Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you, Jim.